Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 168 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is, let's face it, she rises in the east like the sun, Erin Paulette.
How you doing, Erin?
So what you're saying is that I cause blindness and dehydration.
And skin cancer. No, I'm not saying any of that.
You're comparing me to wood grain alcohol.
No, Erin, I would only compare you to ethyl alcohol, the good stuff. It cures all illnesses. I'm living proof.
Yeah, it also kills brain cells. Also living proof of that. Yeah, how am I doing? I didn't get much done this past weekend. I had a real bad case of the I don't wannas, and so I mostly just, you know, farted around and played a lot of City of Heroes and watched some TV and only rarely put on clothes. Well, and I mean, there's part of me that feels bad about that, but for the most part, it's like I needed a mental health weekend.
You said last week, why don't I get a vacation? It sounds like you got a vacation.
Well, I got a little bit of one.
I mean, I got a little bit of one as well. So there we are. Yeah, I got my daughter back. It's...
You sound disappointed.
I love her so much, but oh my goodness. Well, I mean, part of it's also like she's been having a great summer and she's been running around, but it just means that there's this little edge of cranky girl. Plus also she's been spending a lot of time with my parents, who they weren't like this when I was little. They are fun and they're accommodating and they don't scold and they don't judge. I don't know who these old people are, but they aren't my parents.
They rev her up on sugar and junk food and then hand her off to you and say you put her to bed.
That's right. That's right. Or they keep her place and just be like, oh, yeah, we'll put her to bed whenever and all that. And just send her home just like completely exhausted and pouchy eyes. Like when she was just a little tiny baby and she was just old enough that we were just like, yeah, we can let your parents keep her for a weekend and we can get a little bit of time away. And we'd get her back, and in just the first couple of days, it would just be rough. She'd just be fussy and cranky and all that. And my wife looked at me and goes, do you think she resents us? Do you think she thinks we're abandoning her? And then, like, I remember I called her at work, and I'm like, yeah, she just took a five-hour nap in the afternoon. I think she was just exhausted. Oh, but yeah, but she came back and we got her glasses, and oh my goodness, this was like one of like this just this strange like parenting things on the all right. So I mean, I wear glasses and my wife wears very thick glasses, and so yeah, that the idea that she might have bad eyesight is pretty much a given, but it was strange in the fact that she seemed to be able to see things just fine, but she like wasn't able to like read letters far away. And then she even started talking about like, yeah, it feels like the letters are like moving around on the page on me. And I just went, well, that sounds like it might be dyslexia. So we'll talk to somebody else after we finish talking to the eye doctor. But it turns out like, I did not, I mean, obviously such a thing can exist, but I hadn't even thought about it. My daughter has 20/20 vision, but she also has astigmatism in both eyes.
Oh, geez.
And that's what was causing stuff to bounce around and her having difficulty seeing things. And,
oh, God. Oh, geez. Okay. I have astigmatism and I had a touch of it in like high school and like, you know, in my 20s, and I'm in my 40s now, and it's pretty bad. I'm sure you know, not theoretically, I'm sure you have a definitional understanding of astigmatism, but I don't think you've really experienced it.
Oh, I have. I've got it in both eyes.
Oh, okay. How bad is yours?
I've... I don't know the qualifications for it. I think I've got my prescription. I just had an eye exam the other day, but I don't know the exact prescription of it. I've got dyslexia, okay. So it wouldn't stick. But my left eye is, which is my dominant eye. I'm cross-eyed dominant. Good for me. My left eye is pretty bad, and my right eye is mild.
Mm. Well, I mean, my astigmatism really started bothering me when I started doing a lot of these long drives across country for OBS and things like that. And I'd be looking at the road ahead, and the best way to describe it is that my vision would tear, and my left eye vision would sort of float up, and so I would be seeing double, but one on top of the other, and it was just really jarring. Mm-hmm. And the only way for me to fix that would be if I tilted my head to my left. That would somehow bring it into focus. And that was really annoying, but it really only happened on these drives when I'm looking off into the far distance. And this year, it got so bad that it's like, it's happening when I'm watching the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have to have prisms to correct this. And the eye doctor, you know, he's doing this. I don't really know how prisms work, other than they account for the astigmatism. And he's like, you know, he got the thickest prism, and it only partially fixed it. So what he had to do was then get the other eye with prisms in the other direction, you know, basically force one up and one down so that they meet mostly in the middle. Oof. And yeah. And, you know, I'm not 50, but I can see it from here. And
okay. not the way you're describing it.
Shots fired. But I mean, you see my point. I mean, you know, when you're firmly in middle age, you know, the vision does start to go. And for her to be having that at such a young age, and it's gonna get worse. I really feel bad for her. I hope she doesn't end up with those really thick Coke bottle glasses.
Yeah.
Hopefully the technology will evolve by then or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my astigmatism has not changed very much. The doctor just said, I just went and had an eye exam, as I said, like literally took her in for a glass exam and said, you know what, while I'm here, why don't you book me for whatever you've got? And so I had the eye exam, I literally was like, you know what? I find myself like, if I'm looking at like, if I'm doing like fine work, like if I'm doing like detail cleaning of a gun, or I'm looking at an insect or something like that, I realize I peer underneath my glasses.
And, yeah, I just take mine off.
Yeah, and just recently, I've found that if I'm reading like a book, especially my Kindle at nighttime, one of the front lit ones. If I'm reading a book, you know, in the dark, I find that if I take my glasses off, suddenly I can read a whole lot better. And mm-hmm. So I'm like, you know what? I've got no pride. You listen to this show, you know that I've got no pride. I said, let's just do this. Why don't we talk about getting progressive lenses, and I'll just get the reading lens put into that. And luckily for me, he's like, yeah, you don't need them. It's just your eye. It actually, literally, my eyesight actually had gotten better. So I'm looking through too thick farsighted lens, and so he's going to be dialing that back and changing the astigmatism a little bit. But overall, my astigmatism has not shifted, unfortunately, the way yours has. So hopefully,
so just to be clear, when you say progressive, that's the fancy word for bifocals, right?
That's the fancy word for bifocals. But the progressive means that essentially it's a progressive curve to the lens, so that you don't have that sharp line that you would see with someone wearing bifocals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, but my daughter got her new glasses, and she was so excited. Like she came home this weekend, and she's like literally at the eye doctor's. I'm like, you guys open on Saturday? And he's like, nope, we used to be, but after COVID, we've shut down for the weekends. I said, that's cool. And my daughter came in, can I get my glasses? I'm like, nope, we have to wait till Monday. Oh, how will I ever live? And so And so, yeah, we got her glasses, and oh my God, she was just like so excited, and just like she was looking at things far away. And then she's like, "Let's go to the library." And we went to the library, and she was reading books. And oh my God, her reading had gotten like so much better. She would normally get to a big word, she would start trying to sound it out, and I thought she'd just get sick of it and just move on, and you know, and just give up. But nope, it turned out that probably the fact that I don't think we've defined it for the listeners, but astigmatism is when it is, instead of your lens not being able to focus on things, it is your eye is not perfectly round. There is a defect in the curvature of your eye. And so I guess in theory, that means that it's kind of like looking through a funhouse mirror a little bit, is that it warps the image that you have. And so, yeah, because of that, like she said, the letters seem to be jumping around the page, or sometimes she'd lose what line she was on in the book. And suddenly with that corrected, oh my God, is she a better reader? So I think second grade's going to be awfully nice for her.
Well, that's great.
Well, you know, it's not going to be a nice year, Aaron.
I was just going to do the same thing.
The NRA is again having not another nice year, and it turns out that the NRA annual meeting is canceled again.
This is my shock.
I know. When we were all sitting in Indianapolis, and I was making jokes, I actually listened to the podcast. It was last year when the meeting was canceled. And I just happened to listen to that old podcast, and I was just like, and I was me making jokes about the this could be the last one, because of course that was the big one where the letter from Oliver North was submitted, and Wayne LaPierre was going back, and it just kept developing and continued to go, because of course we didn't know about the closed door meeting went. We just knew that Wayne LaPierre was again going to be the executive vice president. He survived the vote of no confidence, but then a bunch of board members resigned, saying, "No, I voted against him." And he's saying it's anonymous, it's unanimous. And so, yeah, that's not how this works. So they're claiming it's COVID. Do you believe this, Aaron?
Well, I mean, I'm sure COVID factored into it, so it's not an outright lie.
I think it is.
But I don't think it's the main reason, no.
I think it's an outright lie. I mean,
well, so here's the thing. One thing you didn't have in your show notes, and I added it neener, is that on the PA Gun blog last week, Bitter actually wrote a blog post about how the NRA exhibits, they were down by 1.4 acres. And there's a PDF of all the booths that have pulled out. And we're not just talking the small ones either, but, you know, big, big, noticeable ones. Like, there's one here that's 130 feet long by 70 feet wide. And that would just be standing empty. And that that would be really, really bad optics.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, well, you and I have been to the Houston Convention Center. I don't know how many of our listeners have, but that's the biggest venue I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was huge, you know, one of those, yeah, I'm going to the other end, I'll see you tomorrow. And it was so big. Okay, so you know how Saturday is the busiest of all the NRA days, and there's this crush of people, and if you're like me and you hate people or hate feeling crowded, you just avoid it. Yeah, in Houston, it was so big that they could actually make the aisles wider, and I didn't feel crowded. It's that big.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you've got that big a venue with just big, gaping chunks of exhibitor space missing, that looks really, really bad. And that would be another black eye to an organization that's already suffering a lot of really bad optics involving Wayne LaPierre and the lawsuit that's been levied against them by New York. And so this would be just another example of NRA failure. And so that is, as far as I'm concerned, the optics is the main reason why they did it. They just decided that COVID was a very handy and not completely untrue reason. I mean, you know, well, why did some of these people pull out? Well, it might have been for concerns of COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not saying that it's that their pants are outright on fire, but they're probably smoldering a bit.
Yeah, I'm looking at this, and here's the big one that got me is, so there's the main, and I mean, obviously there's a million and one doors on this place. This place is gigantic. I mean, it's just the, mm-hmm. I think I said it to you, Aaron, when we were going into the Dallas Convention Center of the, every time I am going into a city towards the convention center for the NRA annual meeting, I'm always greeted with something that looks like the set piece from a sci-fi movie. Just something mm-hmm. that is just impossibly huge and futuristic looking. And it's always been just like that. And so it's, you know, it looks like it's like the hangar bay for some gigantic starship. And mm-hmm. the Houston Convention Center is no different than that. But of course, there is like a big central entrance. And it's like a giant rectangular building. And on one corner is essentially the main entrance to the building. And when you enter into the exhibit hall floor, the first place you get is an NRA booth. And supposedly mm-hmm. there's quite a few of these, but front and center, there's an NRA booth. And then behind it is an empty booth, and then Hornaday.
Mm-hmm.
And then
behind those, you have that huge empty booth I was describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that is like dead center. That is like, that's going to be like the first booth that most people go to. And I'm just amazed by that. It's just front and center, this super duper prime booth. Though I think that might be one of the bigger ones. I think that is the biggest one. And so, and I know.
Do you think it might have been Remington?
I mean, it could. I mean, Remington usually does have a booth that's that size. I mean, they had the. I'm trying to remember what convention it was, but there was like their 100th year anniversary, and they had kind of, they brought like museum pieces in and showed like, the guns to the ages of Remington. So yeah, that was a huge booth. Though Beretta usually has a gigantic one too, and they're considerably smaller. And also what surprises me is that we've heard originally that NRA was offering free upgrades to the various gun makers if they wanted to get that. And so why someone like Smith & Wesson or Beretta or even Glock, who tends to be able to have like a lot of, you know, can really fit a lot of material in there, why wouldn't they take that? I mean, they don't have to pack it in. They could stretch their feet out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, it's just amazing. This was a great find, Aaron. I highly recommend everyone go to the show notes and read this article by Bitter and have a look at the PDF that she links to that shows the floor plan at least as currently as she could get it. So that's pretty awesome as far as information goes. It's not awesome for the NRA. Also, I mean, again, the whole dysfunction with the board and the fact that, I mean, it's, you know, people often forget, because I don't go there to do boring stuff, that it's not a giant gun show and social convention. That's what I use it for. But in fact, it is the annual meeting of the National Rifle Association, and they can't even fill their board positions right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, and the pending lawsuit from New York and all that, I think better to just have something on the down low with not a whole lot of press and attendance is where I'm suspecting.
You mean like they did last year?
I mean, exactly like they did last year. I think that worked out well for them as far as well could go.
Well, I mean, it worked out well for them. Not so much for the members, but okay.
Mm-hmm. Not like they've cared. I said it.
True. remember when I was upset because someone at the NRA didn't like the fact that I had said some snarky things about them appointing Oliver North as president because it was per optics and how dare I? And I was just, oh, well, dang. I mean, I've burned a bridge and I'm just going to have to deal with it. And now I'm just looking back at this and going, ha ha.
And I mean, I said it when that all came out on, you know, on the podcast is the, you burned a bridge and you upset some people. You weren't wrong though. Like,
yeah,
I won't disparage Oliver North. It's certainly, he has done a whole lot to redeem himself in his actions as the NRA president on the accusations. I mean, he really brought a lot of this stuff that was known but wasn't super well known to the forefront of everything, and including the fact that he stepped down as president after doing all that was just, I mean, it was, that was a good move in my opinion. That was done in very good form. Even though he has done good things, again, he's known for the Iran-Contras. He's known for illegal arms deals. It's not great. It wasn't great optics.
So, speaking of shafts, it's not always the length that's important. Sometimes it's girth as well. And of course, I'm talking about the dimensions of a firearms chamber. Get your head out of the gutter. David is here to explain more.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to talk about the whys and hows of chamber casting. The purpose of making a chamber casting is to get the internal dimensions and characteristics of a firearm's chamber. Since it's nearly impossible to measure the inside of a chamber with conventional tools, standard procedure is to make a chamber casting that results in a negative impression of the chamber and is much easier to measure. Chamber castings are made for a number of reasons, including to find out if the chamber has any damage or excessive wear that might cause function and reliability issues, to determine the various chamber measurements for optimizing reloading, such as the neck, shoulder, etc., to determine the details needed to make a custom bullet mold, to find out if the marking on the barrel matches the actual chamber on a used and possibly modified firearm, and even to remove a separated case from the chamber. The most common material used for making a chamber cast is sold under the trade name Cerosafe. It's an alloy of bismuth, lead, tin, and cadmium. The most important attributes of chamber casting metal are its low melting point, generally between 160 and 190 degrees Fahrenheit, that it shrinks slightly as it cools for ease of removal, yet an hour or so after casting, it returns to its cast size for accurate measurement, and when employed properly, it's nearly infinitely reusable. To make a chamber casting is fairly straightforward, but it does require some prep and care. The process is as follows. Make sure the barrel and chamber are clean and dry. Remove any parts such as the bolt that would prevent easy access to the barrel. If possible, remove the barrel from the gun. From the muzzle end of the barrel, insert a patch jag with a snug-fitting patch to form a plug for the casting material. The plug should not be too snug, or it could complicate removal, nor should it be too loose, as that could allow casting metal to leak past. Ideally, the plug should be positioned no less than 1 inch past the end of the chamber. Place the barrel in a secure fixture, pointed muzzle down. Once this is all set, heat the casting metal in a small ladle. The cast iron style ladle that's used for bullet casting is ideal. An electric hot plate or a small gas torch are good heat sources. Note the time, then carefully pour the molten casting metal into the chamber. Use a metal tube or funnel if necessary. Fill the chamber to just above the edge, but not so much that it spills over, since this can make it difficult to remove the casting. If too much casting metal is added, just invert and heat the barrel with a heat gun until it comes out. This won't harm the metal of the firearm, but may damage a wood or plastic stock, so be careful. It usually only takes a few minutes for the chamber casting to cool sufficiently for removal. Look for the metal to dull as a sign. Once the casting metal is firmed up, carefully push the chamber casting out from the muzzle using a cleaning rod or a brass or wooden dowel. If the casting seems to stick, strike the base of the rod or dowel with the palm of your hand. This should only take a few gentle blows to loosen. Take care that the chamber casting doesn't get damaged during removal. Having a soft pad in place is a good idea. A folded towel works well for this purpose. Remember when I suggested noting the time? Wait at least a full hour after casting to take any measurements. This allows the chamber casting to return to its as-cast size. If it's necessary to keep chamber castings for later reference, make sure they're clearly labeled regarding source, firearm, etc., and stored in a container that will protect them from damage. Brownells offers a selection of plastic tubes and caps that will work well for this purpose. If there's no need to save them, they can simply be remelted for the next chamber casting. While making a chamber casting isn't an everyday skill, being able to determine specific details about a firearm's chamber can be extremely useful. It's just another tool, or skill, to keep in the skill box.
It's my fault, Aaron.
You know, you could have led with that.
Yes, ma'am.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me, or suggestions for future segments, or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Yeah, I gotta say, there's some things. I mean, I'm often speaking out against the firearm laws and regulations, but I really like the bit where you stamp what the gun is chambered in on the barrel, so that if you get a gun with an aftermarket barrel, you don't have to go. Is it 9mm? Is it 40 Smith & Wesson? Is it some strange Wildcat cartridge?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I completely agree. In fact, I agree so much that this extends to knives as well. I would really prefer if all knives came with a stamping that told me at what angle the blade was sharpened so I know how to replicate that.
Mm-hmm.
That would just save me so much more effort than having to, okay, is this a 20 or a 25 or a, you know, is it hollow ground or is it... just say it right there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Yeah, critical information where you can see it. Good.
Oh, and I also I sent David a quick message when I heard his segment, and I wanted to know. It wasn't exactly clear. I'm like, hey, when you put the patch down the bore to catch the molten metal, do you pull the patch out with the patch jag? Or do you hammer it out through the breech with the chamber plug? And David says when he does it, he pushes the patch out with the plug. I don't know if it makes much of a difference.
I really wouldn't know, but that is good information to have.
Yeah.
All right, Weird. I understand you have a Fisk for us.
Yes. Speaking of good information, so I talked about the debate between Colleen Noir and John Rosenthal back in episode 165, and I promised a Fisk of the anti-gun talking points left on the field. And without further introduction, here is that Fisk. Back in episode 165, I talked about a debate between Colleen Noir, who needs no introduction, and John Rosenthal, who very much needs an introduction. Mr. Rosenthal is the head of Massachusetts-based Stop Handgun Violence. And they were both on a Newsweek podcast that features debates on contentious issues. As I said in that episode, I wanted to Fisk Mr. Rosenthal, not because Colleen needed any help, but because the sheer numbers of lies and misinformation were so plentiful, Colleen just didn't have time to address them all. So first up, if you haven't listened to this debate yet, give it a listen, because I have never in my life seen a debate so handily won on what seems to be a very neutral stage. Colleen won the debate with skill, but also John lost the debate with blatant dishonesty and bad faith arguments. He lost so badly that even the debate moderators sounded embarrassed at what a spectacle he was making of their podcast. So yeah, Colleen, you crushed it, and it was amazing. But a lie should never be left unchallenged, and there were some interesting talking points that weren't addressed. So the following sound clips are anti-gun talking points I don't think Colleen got a chance to address.
here in Massachusetts, urban Massachusetts, we've reduced gun deaths by the rate of gun deaths by 40%.
So this is one mistake Kolyan made going into this debate. While this is a discussion on national gun policy, Mr. Rosenthal is the head of a Massachusetts anti-gun group, so it should have been expected that he would be bringing up Massachusetts gun laws and speak of them in a positive light. This, of course, is the biggest crux of the gun control debate. Supporters of gun control claim that gun control makes people's lives better, and Second Amendment advocates note that gun control makes our lives worse. We don't even need to get into freedom, founding fathers, enemies foreign and domestic, to win this debate. We just need to tell the truth. And the truth is, Massachusetts' violent crime rate has dropped about the same as the national average. And the bulk of the states in the U.S. saw a drop greater than Massachusetts without passing draconian gun laws. Further, while Massachusetts is hardly the most dangerous state in the Union, it's far from the safest. I posted this article in a previous FISC, but Massachusetts is actually 26th by safety, right in the middle. Do you know who the top three states are? Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. The three states with an easy driving distance of Massachusetts. They also have the least restrictive gun policies in the country. Vermont has some pretty horrible gun laws, but they're relatively recent arrivals and still way less restrictive than the crap we have in Massachusetts.
We're an urban state with the lowest gun death rate in the nation, the lowest cost of gun violence.
I don't even know how to tackle this. Honestly, I can understand why Kolyan left this line alone. Because what does this even mean? Urban state? I mean, Boston's kind of a big city, and the metroplex around Boston stretches out quite a bit. But outside of that, you get a lot of small cities and towns. And outside these towns, you're driving through forests, hills, and farmland. Out west, we have Worcester and a reasonably sized Springfield. But then there's lots of mountains and forests before you hit Vermont, upstate New York, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. And what even is cost of gun violence? It certainly can't include the cost of police officers who process gun licenses, the staff that maintain our gun registry, and the testing centers that approves or denies our handguns for sale in the state. I really think this is all just weasel words that mean nothing, but make it sound like Massachusetts is awesome and that John knows what he's talking about.
We have the lowest gun death rate in the nation here in Massachusetts.
According to the CDC, we do. But it doesn't mean we're safer, especially since much of that gun death is suicide.
So what we did is simply look at the gun constituent groups and, like with automobiles, put in place laws and regulations that require accountability and responsibility on the part of gun owners, gun dealers, gun manufacturers, and law enforcement.
Note in the gun constituent groups, he never mentions criminals because it was never part of the equation. In Massachusetts, you harass lawful gun owners and give the gangs a good leaving alone.
We require safe storage and safety training like automobiles.
First up, safe storage has been declared unconstitutional through Heller versus DC and McDonald versus the City of Chicago. Why it's still on the books here is beyond me, but it's illegal, and Massachusetts does it, and John Rosenthal praises it. Also, I can only speak about Maine and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but you do not need to take driver's ed to get your driver's license in either of those states. I suspect most other states in the Union are similar. But most people don't even know this, because that rule only applies to adults. If you're like most Americans and you get your driver's license at 16 or 17, you need to take driver's ed and log time on a learner's permit. You could still do that at any age, and I believe there's an insurance break if you have done this. But if you don't want to, you just need to take the written exam and pass the driving test, which isn't a hard test at all. So yeah, given that you can't get an FID until your 18th birthday in Massachusetts and an LTC on your 21st, John is being misleading here.
We became the first state in the nation to require that gun manufacturers put minimum safety features into their guns, like trigger locks and magazine disconnects if the magazine is not in the handle of the gun.
I think it's the handgun safety roster he's talking about here, which was created by Massachusetts Attorney General Tom Riley in 2000. This was really more about passing gun control laws without needing to go through Congress and the governor. The trigger lock thing is correct, though Bill Clinton had mandated new handguns be sold with a lock in the 90s. Used guns must also be sold with a lock in Massachusetts. Some shops legitimately force you to buy one of their trigger locks before you can leave with a used handgun. Most shops will let you supply your own lock. I keep a few cheap trigger locks in my car for this very reason. Or the shops I frequent let me just drop the gun into a pocket or into my waistband and carry it concealed out to my car. But the whole magazine disconnect thing is just nonsense. Also, I will note that one of the most glaringly absent guns from Massachusetts gun shops are Glock pistols. Because Glocks are deemed by the Attorney General to be unsafe for sale in Massachusetts. This should show you how rational and objective our safety tests are.
Here in this country, you know, we prohibit the National Consumer Product Safety Commission from regulating real guns, but they have to regulate toy guns and teddy bears. That's insane.
Just as insane as the ATF doesn't regulate the toy gun industry. We read a lot about these frivolous lawsuits that led to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. But really, outside of that, all I can think of is the murky lawsuits about defective Remington 700 triggers, where a gun was actually unsafe. Generally, from High Point to Nighthawk Custom, the guns you buy today are extremely safe. Oh, and neither High Points nor Nighthawk Customs are allowed to be sold in Massachusetts because they're too unsafe. Because reasons.
And then we created a opportunity like with automobiles where it's discretionary licensing based on your history. And law enforcement literally can, police officers who issue the licenses here in the state, like a car license, they have discretion. If they know that you've had a history of violence, but say there hasn't been a restraining order taken out against you. And that led to red flag laws.
Where the hell are driver's license issued with discretion? I mean, if you get into enough moving violations or get caught drunk driving or kill someone, you'll lose your license. But also, you'll eventually get that license back. In Massachusetts, the chief in many towns won't issue certain licenses carte blanche. Have you ever heard of a person who has a driver's license that can only be used between their work and their home? Because we do that crap in Massachusetts, the gun licenses.
All of this is to say the only thing we ban are military-style assault weapons and large-capacity ammunition magazines because law enforcement are given 13 to 17 rounds in their service weapons. Where's the logic in giving the general public 35 to 100 round magazines to outgun police without even an ID or a background check?
Except they have effectively outlawed many of the most common handguns. Yes, you can own new production Glocks in Massachusetts. But a Massachusetts FFL can't sell you one. And an out-of-state FFL won't sell you one either, but will transfer it to a Massachusetts FFL, which can't sell it to you. And it's illegal to buy a gun in a private sale across state lines. So the only way to get an off-roster handgun is A, buy one from somebody who moved into the state with a gun collection, B, have someone die and leave it to you in their will, or C, buy it from a cop who bought it through their department. So yeah, it's not a ban at all. Also, the military-style assault weapon thing? Yeah.
I have a very simple question for you, John. Can you define what an assault weapon is?
Yeah. An assault weapon like the AR-15 that was used in Sandy Hook, where my friends had to identify their children by their clothing because after getting 3 to 11 rounds each with a 223 round made them indistinguishable. Now, that is not a weapon you use for hunting.
Did you notice that he didn't define what a military-style assault weapon is? Yeah, neither does our attorney general. To determine if a semi-auto rifle with a detachable magazine is not an assault weapon, an example must be submitted to the AG's office, and they will say yes or no, but never elaborate.
The AG's office say they fielded about 100 calls in the first couple of weeks after the ban was announced to clarify what guns were legal and what guns weren't.
We're saying that the law applies. Those are copies and duplicates, and we're going to enforce the law with respect to the sales of those copies and duplicates as well.
But the AG's office hasn't put out a definitive list of banned copycat weapons, just the two-step test of attributes that new guns might have that could be considered illegal. And gun store owners feel like they're left to guess at what's okay to sell. But from the Attorney General's point of view, making that list of banned guns public would mean going back to the same cat and mouse game that lawmakers and gun manufacturers have been playing for years, when manufacturers would create new versions of banned guns to evade the law.
And I didn't dismiss the bit about him claiming cops are outgunned. I mean, you could see how Kolyan wasn't able to address all these anti-gun talking points.
Well, I don't agree. I don't agree because that's not a weapon that law enforcement carries. And if you want to create an arms race, no, they're service weapons or service handguns with 13 to 17 rounds.
Well, not SWAT team for being specific here.
What's that?
Well, I mean, your standard cop you see on the street in like Boston or New York City is obviously going to be carrying a 9mm or something like that. But I mean, like SWAT teams and like tons of like federal and local law enforcement carry rifles. Of course they do.
For SWAT.
Literally every police vehicle in most cities and towns in America will have an AR-15 in them. And that includes Massachusetts. Further, I have on multiple times seen Massachusetts Transit Authority cops with full auto MP5s. Sometimes this was at a special event or after the Boston Marathon bombing, but the first time I saw it, the police had chased a shooting suspect down into the subway station where I was waiting for a train. It was literally the first day I had carried concealed on the subway, and I thought they might have been looking for me. And in the previous clips, he does the standard line about 30 to 100 round magazines. But Massachusetts bans magazines that hold 11. So the 11 to 13 round magazines cops carry that he implies is okay is illegal for Massachusetts residents to own.
I hunt. And when I hunt, I have to get a license. And when I hunt deer, I'm limited to 5 rounds. And when I hunt duck, I'm limited to 3 rounds to protect the duck and deer population. Why is it? Where's the logic that when you hunt humans, no limit?
So I'm playing this for 2 reasons. Number one, to point out that magazine limits and hunting seasons are there to protect wildlife populations for future generations. Now, hunting humans is called premeditated murder, and that's illegal. If your gun is single shot or holds 1,000. Or if you kill someone with a $5 hammer or a knife you bought at a gas station. People lawfully carry guns to protect themselves and others from violent threats. And frankly, I want all the help I can get when my life or the lives of my loved ones are on the line. And if that means we wipe out all the rapists, murderers, and other violent criminals so future generations don't have to deal with them, I'm comfortable with that. Also, he does this appeal to authority as a hunter and gun owner, which really shouldn't work on anybody. But after that bit about the damage a 223 round does, he questions Kolyan Noir when he says he's hunted with a 223. This really brings that into question. Most of these anti-gun boomer FUDs haven't held a valid hunting license since Ronald Reagan has left office. But questioning if a 223 is used for hunting makes me wonder how serious a hunter he is in the first place. I mean, I've hunted prairie dogs with a 223 rifle, and I don't identify myself as a hunter.
There have been 374 mass shootings, more than days of the year this year, and that's of 4 or more people.
Again, we know all this is nonsense. When we think mass shootings, we think Columbine, Sandy Hook, Sutherland Springs. Meanwhile, John Rosenthal is using the Bloomberg Mother Jones inflated definition, where 4 or more people are injured in a shooting event. This means they can classify gangland shootings as mass shootings without addressing the problems of inner city violence that they have zero concern about.
We have more gun violence in America than the 26 industrialized nations combined.
We have more gun violence than these bunch of countries I cherry picked because they have less gun violence than we do, which also includes suicides. And we aren't going to talk about violent crime like rape and murder because only gun crime counts.
So private dealers can operate selling guns without background checks to anyone, cash and carry with no ID.
Private dealers implies that they're in the business of selling guns. Nate Spencer, who does our music, sold me a car he owned once. Does that make Nate a private car dealership? Further, it's illegal to sell guns across state lines and illegal to sell to criminals. So you will almost never find a private seller not willing to ask for at least some ID. Heck, when pro-gun legislators attempted to open up the NICS system so private sellers could conduct background checks, who killed it in committee? Chuck Schumer. Who spoke out against it? Gun control lobbyists like John Rosenthal.
So Massachusetts happens to have the lowest gun death rate. We're an urban state, by the way. We're not a rural state. We're an urban state. And we happen to be next to Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont that don't have background checks for private gun sales. But Massachusetts has New York and New Jersey and states that are urban states but have effective gun laws have lower gun death rates than Texas, Wyoming, you name it. You name the rural states.
Lowest gun death rate, but not lowest violent crime. And you just named the states with a lower violent crime rate than Massachusetts. And they're the ones that let people buy the guns they want, carry them without a permit, open or concealed. And what's with the urban versus rural nonsense? If guns cause crime and violence, then when you adjust the deaths per capita, it shouldn't matter. But it does. The big issue is that violent crime is caused by things like gangs, drug use, poverty, family history of incarceration, among many other things. It's a very complicated issue. And people like John Rosenthal would just like to ban guns and punish lawful gun owners and pretend that social stuff like this doesn't even exist.
The problem is that, you know, domestic terrorists and even international terrorists come to states and to U.S. gun shows where there are no background check requirements, buy their weapons, and then bring them to states where and countries where it's harder to get guns.
Don't forget the gray-skinned aliens who buy guns at the New Hampshire gun shows and take them back to the Theta Reticuli system to fight the evil war against Emperor Snurr. Because I have just as much proof of that as John does. But you know what I do have proof of? In 2005, John Rosenthal teamed up with Boston Globe reporter Steve Bailey, and they went to a New Hampshire gun show to show how easy it was to get a gun. No questions asked. Except everybody did ask questions. So John had to pay a local corrections officer to buy a gun for him. And then he returned to Boston to tell the world about how we need common sense gun control. And then the ATF descended on Bailey and Rosenthal and demanded they see the gun they bought. Turns out it was still in New Hampshire. Because the gun laws are so lax up there, they didn't dare break them. And technically being given cash by a third party, many anti-gunners consider that an illegal straw buy too.
Federal gun policy is to have unrestricted access to easily concealed handguns and military-style weapons and large-capacity ammunition magazines, cash and carry without any knowledge whatsoever of anybody's background or intent or history in 32 states.
Oh no, the sky is falling. Thankfully, John Rosenthal is here to help us become more like violent crime rated number 26 state, Massachusetts. Or better yet, number 14, California. Rather than Maine, which has constitutional carry, no restrictions on NFA items, no restrictions on what guns or magazines you can buy, and private sales are legal. And it's number 50, the safest state in the union. Two soldiers, one mission. Colleen Noir was in it to win it. And he crushed John Rosenthal in the debate. And it was amazing work. I swooped in to make sure no lies were left unchallenged. I think we did a great job. And John Rosenthal, you did a great job too. For the Second Amendment. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Wow. Yeah, I've unfortunately debated people like that on Facebook, and it's a case of, oh my god, I don't even know where to begin, because there's so many things wrong in your sentence, and you're either arguing from bad faith or you're completely ignorant, and I don't have the mental capacity to educate you on everything you have wrong. Just,
And what makes it doubly frustrating is the fact that, like, either it's just you and that person just debating, so there is no objective third party whatsoever, or there is a third party, and the third party is far from objective. It's kind of like Godwin's law. Any argument will mention the Nazi party if it goes on long enough. Any Second Amendment argument will have somebody that's done in public will have somebody jump in and yell "shall not be infringed," and just screw everything up.
You know, that really doesn't bother me that much. I'm kind of drawing a blank. Okay, what actually bothers me more is when I'm trying to have some sort of educational debate with someone, and I think maybe I can reach them, and then you've got somebody who comes in and just pisses over everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the equivalent of, well, I don't give a dang what you've just said. You know, you're just one of them, you know, Democrat liberals, so-and-so, and it's just, oh, God. So, yeah, you've come in with the name-calling, and now you've just, you have mined the field here that I'm trying to find common ground on. Ugh. So, yeah, that's basically my review of this thing. Just, I was so exasperated. Just, ugh, is the best way to summarize that. Good Lord, how did you get through that?
I mean, I got through it just because this is one that had like legitimate, like objective moderators. It had a structure. It was an actual debate, and in the face of an actual debate with moderators and all that, John Rosenthal had, I mean, just the mental immaturity to think that he could just lie and make stuff up and just talk out of his rear and make bad faith arguments, like just trying to do gotcha points. And he got called on them, like literally, like it's the, unless you are like the most diehard anti-gun person on the planet and Michael Bloomberg can do no wrong, including his, you know, issues with personnels in his corporation and all of that stuff. Unless you are like that far down the rabbit hole that you're like apologizing for Michael Bloomberg and Harvey Weinstein, you're going to say, God, he got trashed. Like Colin, you are dusted him up right proper. And so it just, that feeling of justice that just doesn't really exist in the debate very often really, really just was delicious.
Okay, well, I didn't listen to the debate, and I did listen to your Fisk, and I didn't hear them call him on his BS most of the time. But if you assure me they called him on it, okay, that makes it a lot better.
Aaron, I have said this every single time I've mentioned this. Aaron, you need to heed me out. It's like about an hour, and I have in the show notes a link to the YouTube video, but also to a podcast. So if you want to just listen to it on earbuds, there's no visual component to it. So you won't miss out on anything listening mm-hmm. to it. And those of you who are listening who might have like a commute, or you're going to be, you know, hop on your lawnmower this weekend to mow the lawn, and all that, just this is something you could just listen to. So you don't need to be sitting in front of a screen. Just listen to it. It is, Colian does such a good job, and John Rosenthal does such a bad job, and justice is served. It is amazing. I think you should all listen to it. And of course, as you heard in the Fisk, he didn't get them all. Like he got, those are just the talking points that Colian either didn't touch or took lower hanging fruit, or took a better scoring options than nitpick each and every little thing. So yeah, it's listen to it. It's don't sell yourself short. This is the one time when hearing something with that the anti-gunners are going to be talking about is well worth it, because even these moderators who are super duper objective, they're like, what are you doing?
All right. That makes me feel better.
You know what makes me feel good?
Another podcast in the can?
Yes, another podcast in our can, and our lovely listeners. Did you know that our listeners are all really good looking people?
I didn't know that. I mean, I do know that they are big swinging dicks.
they are all also that, and they are alarmingly good looking. Yeah, that's right. I'm talking to you. Just, you're riding in the car. Look in that rearview mirror. Yeah, you're nailing it. And a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To be on a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/SodaCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off. And while you're looking in that rearview mirror, blow yourself a big kiss, baby. You're worth it.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. And of course, you can also hear me on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
I still haven't got around to doing that Linktree thing. I probably should one of these days. Just not now. In the meantime, blue collar prepping .blogspot.com, working rhythmically .blogspot. I just hate saying .blogspot.com is really what it comes down to. And of course, pinkpistols.org and blazingsword.org.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for being an illegal car dealer and making our lovely music. He's not really an illegal car dealer.
He likes to play NetHack. I prefer City of Heroes because it's got more of a plot and better graphics and was actually made this century. Our tastes in games are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Go bravely with costs.